champion becomes a legend. Mackay Beaver has won it.
Perkins goes in first. What a legend. What a champion.
Welcome to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Great to have you with us for another edition of This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Today we celebrate the life of a man who made a remarkable contribution to the game of AFL football in all sorts of ways. Not only because he was part of one of the great teams of recent eras at Geelong, but also individually he collected a couple of the highest honours in the game. The Brownlow Medal, the Norm Smith Medal. He's a champion of the game. His name is Jimmy Bartel. And he's with me in the studio. Jimmy, great to have you along.
G'day. I'm actually really excited to have a chat, Pete.
I'm looking forward to it. We're obviously doing this sitting in a radio studio, and that's part of your new job, being in the media. You always struck me as being a very quietly spoken guy. Yeah. Did you have to sort of learn to come out of yourself a little bit to occupy your role in the media?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. It seems like a bit of a contradiction. I'm getting paid, or my job is to talk, and I'm not a big talker. It sounds strange, but I think you're more comfortable in what you know. I think a lot of people, if you know whatever their passion is and you ask them about their passion, they can talk for days, and I think that's the case with me. I'm unashamedly a sports nut. My whole life has always been sport. I was telling someone the other day, I probably own close to 500 to 600 sporting books at home.
What's your favourite?
It's really difficult to pick a favourite. I'm a massive reader. I'm a bit of a bookworm. I have a lot of books on the go. I have lots and lots of cricket books because the fact of my birthday being in December, you always cricket season, and every sporting hero brings out their book in time for Christmas. So you'd pick up all them, and then Christmas time. But Mum used to always walk around the streets of Geelong, you know, when you know she'd go for a bit of exercise. You know, Mum goes out for a walk, and you'd see a garage sale on Sunday. Everyone's flogging off their old books, you know, 10 books for $10, and Mum would pick up a big swag of those and bring them home, go, here you go, here's some more books. But look, I've read, you know, dozens on Don Bradman, you know, the Steve Waugh Ashes Diaries. We've got first editions of Neil Compton, the cricketer. I've got, you know, basketball, football books. I still remember one of my favourite books is, it was almost like a Bible, and it was a 1970s AFL book, and it was like Stan Elves, Peter Knights and all that, and they were all described how to play the position. You know, so you got Stan Elves describing the wing, you got Peter Knights describing the halfback flank and all that, and how all the nuances of playing it. And it was almost like I taught myself to play football off that book. It's like, you know, where to position yourselves, and you know, so I actually had the old sort of all the old retro footy books that I used to constantly go back and flick through and go, oh, that's how you take a hanger, and absolutely loved it.
So getting back to your career in the media, one of the difficulties for someone like yourself just out of playing is that you've still got a lot of mates who are playing the game, and yet your role at times, by its definition, has to be critical. Are you aware of that, that there is a very fine line between friendship and your job?
Yeah, I am, but I think it can be an advantage too, and I know what you're asking. Like, it does put you in an awkward situation, especially if I'm talking about the Cats, who, if they were to go through a form slump, or a good mate of mine is struggling for his position, for example, or he's coming near the end, or whatever that may be. But I actually think it's an advantage, because the first thing I did when I did venture into the media, I was sort of doing bits and pieces while I was playing, and I still keep it at the top of my notes, is remember how hard the game is, and the game looks simple from this, you know, vantage point. And I always still say that to people, that we can see the space at level two. We can see the game unfolding. And I tell people, if you go shoot some baskets and there's 2-on-2 or 3-on-3 and you try and find the space in the key, you go, you can't find it. Now, AFL football, you put 20 players within a 10-metre space and they're all trying to knock your block off. And then you're asking them to execute the skill and then also deliver it 40 metres away. Now, I'm not making an excuse, but it does help when you critique players. And I still have a fresh idea of how difficult the game is. And I think I've always been a fair and honest person anyway. When I've been with teammates when I was playing, you're always constantly critiquing each other. You're helping, you're improving, you're pushing, you're nudging players. So I've sort of always taken that perspective in, I guess, my media commentary.
You're doing television and radio. Obviously, for those of us who have good heads for radio, that's probably the medium that we prefer. But being the good-looking rooster that you are, TV's pretty kind to you. Which do you prefer? Do you prefer TV or radio?
Yeah, good question. I enjoy the dynamic of radio a lot. What we're doing right now, I feel, is a lot more radio. It's I enjoy the conversation. I enjoy getting a topic or a talking point and thrashing it out with different people, getting their different opinion and perspective. And you can almost hit pause, you know, because you've got to get the ad breaks and things like that, and you can come back to it. TV, a lot quicker. You've got to hit, you know, time points and things like that. So at the moment, I probably enjoy radio because of the more relaxed conversationalist piece about it. TV is different. I like TV, but probably if I had to pick one, probably radio at this stage.
And the thing about TV is that quite often you have to be there 2 hours or 3 hours before anything happens, and yep. You've got to make sure the makeup's right and the hair's right and the clothes are right. And also, you know, if you're wearing the Channel 7 pin,
it's got to be right.
It's got to be absolutely right. Otherwise, there's big trouble there.
Yeah, it is. Look, for people unaware, and you know better than most, is TV, to make 5 minutes of TV probably takes an hour. So, yeah it's very fastidious in that way. And look, everything has to be spot on. But look, that's the way it is. It's still enjoyable. And look, the way I look at TV and radio, I go along on a weekend, I go watch a game of sport, a game of footy, which I absolutely love, and I get to sit next to Lee Matthews, Matthew Lloyd, Tim Watson. Like, are you kidding? Like, these guys have got statues out the front of the MCG, like Lee Matthews. I still pinch myself.
Yeah, there's probably a few saying the same thing about you, actually being able to sit beside you for a game of footy. When did Jimmy Bartel transition from James Bartel?
Yeah, it's a great question. A lot of people think I have legally changed my name or things like that. It's actually a rather boring story, which is kind of funny in a way. So when I arrived at the Geelong Cats, also there was James Kelly, who was in the draft. And the following year, there's James Allen, who went on to win a couple of McGarry medals and a Liston medal, a very good player at the next level, who I went to school with. We also had James Riley, who was already at the Cats. Four Jameses at the club. Ever since I've been a little boy and a little fella, I've always been referred to as Jimmy. It's like James is just the real formal name you put on your driver's license and a passport. I walk past the media manager down there at Geelong Football Club. He goes, "Can we just put your name down as Jimmy?" I go, "Yeah, go for it." And then all of a sudden it all broke out. He's changed his name. Don't refer to him as anything else. And I go, "Call me James, Jim or Jimmy. Just be nice and I'll probably respond."
Gee, they probably have to do that at St Kilda with all the Jacks at St
exactly
Kilda.
Exactly right.
And what about Bailey's at the Western Bulldogs as well?
There's a very popular name, Bailey. Yeah, all the Jacks at St Kilda. There's a lot of Jacks in the competition flat out. But I've always been referred to as Jim or Jimmy. Even my school teachers. I only ever got worried when I got called James, and that was normally my mum was upset with me.
When young Jimmy was just starting to take his first steps and learning to love sport, you were obviously infatuated with football, but you were also a very good cricketer at an early age as well.
I was thinking about this, and when especially the Cricket World Cup was on and the Ashes, cricket is my passion, but I love football as well, and I am so passionate about cricket. I can sit there and watch every single ball of the Test match, and I actually get a little bit disappointed when I turn away and miss a ball. I absolutely love the game. I understand why people don't love it because it's a bit slow moving and things like that. But I don't know, I just always had this with love, the challenge. It's always a different challenge, cricket. I know all sports are, but, there's conditions, there's bat versus ball, there's fielding, there's the history of the game, the fact that you can play the game in so many different ways. And you look at Don Bradman, the greatest of all time. Now, if we were in today's ages, there would have been that many people trying to change his technique. He picked up the cricket bat incorrectly. The way he held the cricket bat was so wrong, but he's the greatest of all time. We look at Steve Smith now, he's probably regarded as the second to Bradman. Now, do you think he's got a normal technique?
No, not at all.
Brian Lara, he picks the cricket bat up near his ears and used to smoke him through the covers. And I just found the game fascinating that you can come at it from so many different angles and people from so many different walks of life play the game.
So given the fact that you have this love of cricket and you were very good at cricket, how did the choice actually come about that football won out over cricket when you had this passion for the other game?
I guess there was a couple of things that were happening. I guess 2020 cricket wasn't where it was even in 2002. Probably the global nature of being able to make a living or take cricket wasn't as, I guess, open as it was. Look, you could still go over and play some, county cricket in England or do things like that. But it was really, if you didn't make the Victorian squad, you sort of would just float around playing some district cricket and things like that. But also football picked me in a way. So I played the National Carnival up there in Queensland over the summer, rolled into my final TAC Cup season with the Geelong Falcons, year 12 exams, draft. And I was picked. So I was 17, the day after my school graduation at St. Joseph's in Geelong, I was kicking the ball to Stephen King and Peter Riccardi and Ben Graham and the host of other young draftees. So It's sort of picked me in a way, and geez, I'm happy it did.
Was it always going to be Geelong, Jimmy? Because I think you were a Tigers supporter as a kid, weren't you?
Yeah, I was a Tigers supporter. Probably the one that I thought I might have ended up was the West Coast Eagles did a couple of visits to my house even the year before when I was ineligible to be drafted because of the age. So I had a lot of chats with the West Coast Eagles. They had obviously pick three, Chris Judd, but they also had pick six, which ended up being Ashley Sampey, the local kid over there in Perth. And they were tossing up, do we go Sampey, who had a really, really good carnival? Do we go, you know, Jimmy Bartel? But we're sort of taking Chris Judd, the midfielder, already. And I think everyone sort of knew the Kangaroos had David Hale in mind. They needed a tall. So it wasn't pick seven. So it was, would it be pick six or pick eight? They went with Sampey. I got told the night before Stephen Wells came around to my house, the Geelong recruiting boss, the guru, who they're building statues of.
Oh, there's got to be a statue for him.
Exactly right. He said, look, if you're there at pick eight, you're coming to the Cats. So just quickly, it was a funny story about draft night. Is it was the first time where they swapped over the TV channels who had the draft, and there was no one really covering it. You had to follow it on the internet. And they held it at the tennis centre now where they do all the tennis stuff there. And you know, all those warm-up courts, the indoor. I remember Mick Turner picked myself up from my house at Geelong because he'd been down to Colac to pick up a pretty handy player in Luke Hodge. Get in the car, and Mick Turner turns around and goes, Luke Hodge is going to be number one pick. You're going to be sitting next to him, act excited. I go, yeah, no worries. And I'd had a pretty late night the night before, celebrating with some Bell Park teammates there, end of season and things like that. So I was a bit sleepy in the days. We get up there, of course, you know, Hawks take Luke Hodge. I'm patting him on the back. They whisk him off, and I just found myself, I was sitting in a chair just sort of by myself with the draft. I actually nodded off. And I sort of came to, and they're in the draft, and they go, they're up to pick 32, Richmond Tigers. And they took Dave Roden. I think it was Richmond's first and only pick for a while that year. And I went, geez, they're up to pick 32. I wonder if I've been drafted yet. And I actually got up. Now, on the old school projector screens, you know, the ones you used to have in school where they write on the plastic and slide it. They had it up there, and I had to sift through that and go, oh, I've gone pick eight to the Cats. I completely missed my name being drafted. And I ran into Stephen Wells. He goes, we've been looking for you. He goes, here's your polo. I go, oh, can I borrow the phone? I need to call Mum and tell her. I called Mum and said, oh, I've been drafted, Mum. And she goes, oh, that's good. Where have you gone? I said, oh, Geelong. She goes, oh, what time were you home for dinner? I said, oh, I think about 5:30. So that was my highlight for my draft day.
So not exactly the most auspicious of starts, no. But thankfully for you, it was going to get better along the way. So much more to tell in the story of Jimmy Bartel, and we'll continue that story on the other side of the break on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hope you're enjoying the chat with the great champion Jimmy Bartel on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. So you're at the Cats.
Yes.
Everybody looks back now and says, Norm Smith, Brownlow medal, 300 games. It must have just all flowed from the word go. But it took a little while for you to establish yourself.
Yeah, it did, I guess. I think what happens too is that we see high draft picks and they're so well prepared now when they come into the game. You think Joel Selwood, even Chris Judd was a freak. And I think they think every player is going to do that path. They just come in and play straight away. I played the first 9 games in my first year. I was rolling. But like I was saying, I came from a cricket background. You know, I'd never done a pre-season of footy. I was fatigued. You start to doubt yourself because you're only 18 years of age. You're playing against guys who are 28, you know, 200 gamers. Like my first game was on Smoking Joe Macedi. Like he could run rings around you because of the experience. And I just think I hit the wall in my first season. The second season, I started much the same. And as you said, like the third season, I think I was still learning to adjust to AFL life, you know, the professionalism, what more that I need to do. Also, the different layers that came with playing in a game. So, you know, I came from junior background. You roll around, you play football for what football is. You just chase a kick and you do things. So I still had a lot to learn about the game, and I was just going through those teething problems. And I think there's a lot of players like that, and you still see it today. If young players don't perform, we want to trade them straight away or he's a bust. But you got to remember, 18 to 20, I was still growing. Like, I was still developing. I was still going from a boy to a man, and, you know, the maturity that comes along with it and just getting used to playing AFL football.
Part of that development, Jimmy, was playing in a VFL flag in 2002. How important was that to your development as a footballer and to Geelong's development as the powerhouse that they eventually became?
Well, that 2002 side was, you know, obviously my first year of footy was pretty much the nucleus of those premiership sides that happened from that era, 2007 onwards, and even final series before it. You know, there was Chapman, Kelly, Johnson, Ablett, you name it. They were all playing. I think it's really important, and you got to have success. And that was the bit of success we had. And now it's a VFL level, a very high level of footy, played against some really good senior AFL players against us. And I think it was just, I don't know, just built the confidence in that group that this group, my draft, and you call it the Cameron Link, Paul Chapman draft, 2 years above Joel Corey Enright, it just sort of, it galvanised that group that, yep, there's rewards for this hard work. If we just, you know, sort of keep banging away on the wall, we'll eventually knock it down. So, yeah, I think that set us up really well going into the future.
Eventually, the steps come towards 2007. That's glossing over a lot of your footballing career, but there are so many things to talk about. 2007 is such a big year in lots of ways. The Brownlow medal, first of all. Did you go that night thinking, I've got a chance of standing up and having this thing hung around my neck at the end of the night?
No, it's kind of funny. When I reflect back on it, I knew I had a very good season, but also it was the first Brownlow medal I'd ever been to because I'd been suspended in previous years. Look, nothing dirty or anything like that, just clumsy accidents, you know, front-on contact when they start the, you know, they, when you're bumping on your space, things like that, just accidents had happened and I'd missed a week, you know, in the previous year. So it was the first Brownlow I'd ever been to. So I was just, cool, I get to go to a Brownlow medal. Like I said, I'm still the biggest footy fan ever. Also, I had in the back of my head, I pretty much missed a game in the middle of the year where I got concussion in the first 5 minutes. It was against the Swans, so that game was out. And I missed the final two games of the year with a burst appendix. So I'm like, oh, well, I'm at least three games down. So I just wanted to actually poll a vote because you don't want to show up to a Brownlow and not poll a vote. It's kind of embarrassing. But you just don't know. You don't know how the umpires view you, how they saw it. I knew my teammates had an unbelievable season as well. Joel Corey, Gary Ablett, Enright, the list goes on. You know, we had nine All-Australians that year. So there's some pretty serious talent in that side. So, look, I just wanted to poll some votes. There's probably one or two games where you thought, oh, yeah, that if I'm going to get votes, that'd be the game I'd get it in. But, yeah, when they read out three votes at round 20, it still wasn't processing in my head that I couldn't get beaten. And it was Joel Corey going, oh, you've won it, mate, before Bruce McAvaney said. And I go, no, there's two rounds to go. And he goes, no, you idiot, you're seven votes clear. In two rounds, they can't catch you. So I was like, oh, gee, I have won it. And, I was in shock, to be honest, because during the night, they were putting up montages of, you know, Rusciuto, Simon Black. You go back to some of the great winners like Bobby Skilton. And I'm just like, I'm watching and go, I actually don't deserve to be on the stage of these guys. And I still remember Adam Goods presenting me the medal hanging over my neck. And I'm like, what's happening? It's just such a whirlwind.
Just before we talk about the grand final, I want to talk about one particular game in 2007 that I think had a lot to do with you making the grand final. I was there. It was about round five or round six. It was against North Melbourne down at Cadenia Park. And it was a bad loss. Yep. Adam Simpson ran around by himself and got 41 touches, I think. It seemed like things turned after that. Is that a fair assumption?
No, I think you're absolutely spot on. Even the results say to that. We came out and played Richmond the following week and, you know, kicked a cricket score at what is now Marvel Stadium, but at the Dome down there. Look, Adam Simpson ran around and got 40 touches. It was a bad loss because of the context, but we lost by four goals. So when you're in the change rooms, obviously emotions are charged. There's, you know, people going, it's another doomed season. Articles came out later that week, you know, shocking list, burn it. I think I had a cross over the top of my head. You know, a dozen of my teammates, you know, no good, which I think about half of them end up being All-Australians at the end of the year. But I think what ended up coming out of it was you often hear these players-only meetings and they can be a bit rubbish and you can say the same sort of things. But I think the thing that hit home for me, and I can only say from my personal point of view, is when Darren Millburn gets up and goes, I don't have many years to waste my career on us just to stuff around and just go through another wasted season. And when that hits home from a player going, this is everything they've ever wanted to do and all they've wanted to do is play AFL football and they want to win a premiership and success, and you feel like all their years that they've done before you've got there, you don't want to waste it and you actually feel guilty that you're doing that to somebody else. And I think everyone sort of embraced that. Now, everyone will point to the Paul Chapman, he came out and said it. But it wasn't just Paul Chapman. It was just the fact that he's put out in front of the media and he was the spokesman for the group. And there wasn't players, you know, standing up and getting aggressive. But it was just when it's put to you in those sort of terms that your career can go by and you can sort of the old, you can count your games but don't make them count. You can really just float along in AFL. And I think when you think, oh, because we were good the year before, we should be good now. Because you go back 2004, we played in a prelim, 2005, the Nick Davis game. That's the easy way to reference
it. No, the bloody Nick Davis game.
The bloody Nick Davis game.
Yeah.
We were a good enough team because it showed it in the previous years as a young side. But then when you get to that point and you just sort of think, oh, it's just going to happen, you sort of need something to really snap you out of it. And for me, it was, you know, when Darren Milburn just said, look, you just can't waste your career. Like, you can go through and just have no impact on a club or no impact on your career, which turns out to be a large proportion of your life.
So whatever he said worked.
It worked for me.
The switch is flicked, and it worked for your teammates as well, because you get to the big day. Not too often, Jimmy, that in a grand final it lasts for 120 minutes that you get to smell the roses for about 100 of them. But that was that day.
Yeah, it was. The fact that probably three-quarter time, you're a huge score up. I think at three-quarter time where you sort of allow yourself to take it in as a player, probably for fans it was a lot earlier. We were, you know, getting to 90 points up at that stage. It is something that is extraordinary to be a part of. It's so hard to describe. You get this rush of energy that you haven't even spent any energy playing. And you take it all in. And for being a Geelong kid, even though I barracked for a different club, I knew what this meant for the Geelong community. I remember it just genuinely felt like we won it for the fans, that premiership.
I remember talking to you in the rooms afterwards. It was on ABC Radio. And what happened that day was Gerard Whateley and Drew Morford, I think, were calling on ABC Radio. And both of them lost their voices at half time. And so I was floating around and I'd done a bit of work for the ABC and they came in, I did the pregame and spoke to you. And I spoke about something that was making a lot of headlines that week. Mm. And that was your relationship with your father.
Mm.
At that time, it would have been difficult at any time, but how difficult was it to combine all of the elements that went through the funnel in that week with what was going on off the field as well?
Yeah, I guess probably that week in particular, Tuesday, you know, after the media sort of, you know, the all-in, as they do, you know, the press conference after I won the Brownlow. You know, I picked up the Herald Sun and, you know, the front page was him on the Herald Sun. And I was a bit of I have to admit, I was an emotional wreck. And Ronnie Watt, who's a lot of people in football know, great football man. He was our VFL coach at the time in 2007. And was a great mentor to me, obviously coming through and coached me a lot. He was a huge help for me, and I felt the timing was horrendous. I'd never spoken to my dad probably about 4 or 5 years before that, and I'm like, you've gone through a newspaper, there was a lot of anger, there was a lot of emotion, and it's like, you know, this is supposed to be the highlight for my football career, you know, not only the Brownlow, but the grand final week, but it also for my family. Like, you can always put yourself aside, but your immediate thoughts go to my two older sisters who, because of me, they've dragged into it because of the profile, and my mum, of course. And so it was a really difficult week, but the fact is Ronnie Watt helped me park it, if you will, on Tuesday. And he goes, we can deal with it later. Your sole dream is to win a premiership for this club. Let's just highlight that and we can deal with it. So, yeah, to say I dismissed it is incorrect, but yeah, it was a really difficult sort of 24 hours where I had to really just rip the band-aid off, deal with my emotions, and then just get back into, call it, work mode, if you will.
Did the reconciliation ever take place?
No, it didn't. The last time I saw him, he ended up passing away with cancer, and like I said, my number never changed. You live in Geelong, everyone knows where you live. No one ever knocked on my door or anything like that. There was never an apology. I think when the moment happened, it was near my 21st birthday in 2004, where I cut ties with him. That was, this might sound really harsh, but that was where it ended. Like, he died to me in a way, if you want to put it really sort of brutally. And I sort of dealt with the mourning of not having my dad anymore, even though he was still alive when I was 21. And when he passed away, when I was close to the 30, I'd sort of already gone through that, a range of emotion. And for me, it was just to be a support network for my two sisters.
So much more to tell in the story of Jimmy Bartell, and we'll continue that story on the other side of the break on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. More with the Brownlow medalist, the great Cats champion, coming up after the break.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hope you're enjoying the chat with the great champion Jimmy Bartel on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. So you've got the flag under your belt, you've got the Brownlow under your belt, it's all just going to happen. We come to 2008, everybody says, Hawthorn, too early for them to win a flag. As it turns out, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't. Unfortunately for us, great for Hawthorn supporters. Look, 2008, I think we only dropped the one game during the year. Collingwood actually smacked us by about 90 points. It was an odd night.
It was remarkable, that game. I remember it as a black and white supporter. It was one of those nights where they could not do a thing wrong, literally.
Yeah, they absolutely wiped the floor with us. It was an eerie night. But look, on reflection, I have a bit of a different point of view. I've heard lots of teammates talk about 2008. Look, of course, I'm upset. It disappoints me. Would I've loved to have gone back-to-back and it's another premiership? All AFL players just want more premierships. You're greedy as all hell. But I look at 2008 a little bit differently, is the fact that you actually got to give your dues to the opposition. The opposition's entitled to play well. And if you go back and look, in hindsight's always 20/20, you look at Hawthorn's form running into the final series. They were a much better performing side. We were getting by on talent, some individual efforts. The Bulldogs in the preliminary final, I think Sean Higgins hits the post.
Mm.
We get over the line by 10 points. We were just going. Like, the Dogs were all over us. And you ask most Doggy supporters, they'd probably agree with us. And we hung on. And we limped into the grand final. We probably learnt the harshest lesson ever, that you don't play players on reputation. You play them on form and fitness. We had a lot of players who were underdone or just going. And we got torched by a Hawthorn side who had a great game plan, obviously all the rush behinds, but they denied us the footy. I think what time has shown is, geez, they've got some of the all-time greats of the game. You know, Mitchell, Hodge, Rioli, Lewis, Franklin, Ruffhead, you go on, and Birchall. They're a pretty damn good side. What it did was, I don't think we would have won 2009 if we hadn't lost 2008. Some people might say, oh, that's rubbish. But the fact is, that burning, as a lot of people, in your guts at three-quarter time, and Bomber Thompson just comes to you at three-quarter time of 2009 and goes, you know the feeling you had this time last year. That's all he had to say. And that's all it was driven, it focused, it was on that, just burning away in your stomach. We probably started off the first club in 2009, the old managed. Do you remember Geelong started us? Yes. There was players being rotated throughout the year.
Which was a sin in football those days. You couldn't say that about a player.
Exactly right. So we started to manage players, started putting bigger workloads into players in the back half of the year, because we'd sealed up top four pretty early. Like, I'm not bragging, but the Cat side was still rolling along. Like, 2009, remember, we were both 13-0 when we met the Saints. So we'd already locked up a top four by about round 15.
One of the greatest home and away games of all time, I reckon, that one.
Yeah, we'll get sidetracked. It's still the best game of football I've ever played in. It was a loss. So 2008, if you didn't learn anything out of it, that could have been the great tragedy. But I don't think we would have had the era. Now, it's a hard way to learn, but I don't think we would have had the era we would have had if we didn't have the Nick Davis game and the 2008 grand final.
So you come to the 2009 grand final. This is how good your career is. We only talk about grand finals now. We've got to leave everything else out. 2009. Was it 2009 you had 16 tackles in the grand final?
Yep, that was it. Yep.
And that was a record?
Yep, it's AFL record for a grand final. I think they've gone past it in games, but it was an AFL record at the time. I started the first quarter on the half forward line. Had seven or eight touches in the first quarter. I was going good. My form was good, but Lenny Hayes was going bananas in the midfield. Bomber Thompson comes roaring down from the box, charging out. He points at me and he goes, "Have you got Hayes?" I said, "No, I'm playing half forward, mate. Where you put me?" And he goes, "You have him for the rest of the game. Do not let him touch it, or else if he does, they'll win." I go, "I'm assuming you want me to tag you." And so that was the job I had after quarter time.
And you did it.
I did. Oh, Lenny Hayes, what a superstar player he was. But again, I had 2008 burning in my head. My focus was, if we're to win, I have to stop Hayes. He was going crazy. I think he kicked a goal. He had, I think, close to 10 touches. He was Norm Smith medal on his neck at quarter time.
Mm. So you've got two premierships in three seasons, 07, 09. We've spoken about what happened in 08. 2010 was close again, almost got there. You said you wouldn't have won 09 without 08. Would you have won 2011 without 2010?
Great question. No, I think Chris Scott came in at the right time and made the adjustments. Also, when you got a new coach, it's you know, a new school teacher or a new friend, you're trying to impress. So again, you come back to pre-season and go, geez, I can't do the same thing I'm doing. And what does Chris Scott think of me? Because Chris Scott's come from the mighty Lions, you know, that dominant side up there under Lee Matthews. What impression does he have of me? Because obviously we've got impressions of players when we go along to the footy and commentate now, don't we? So you're thinking, geez, does he think I'm any good? Am I going to still play the same position? So all the senior players are doing that as well. He tinkered with the game plan. He still knew we had a lot of ability there, and he just made those little adjustments. You know, where we handballed a lot under Bomber Thompson, he sort of dialed that a bit back. He moved certain players to the forward line. Let's take the contest on a little bit more forward of the play. What Collingwood were doing, because they were such a great side in 2010, like starting to build a game plan to beat them. You take the contest a little bit further on. The way you defend, we went a bit more to the what is now, you know, all that zone defence, you know, but you defend it a little bit different way. We did it our own Geelong way.
2011 comes along, and at half time, you've got a predicament again. Yep. Collingwood's doing well. You talked about what Bomber said to you in 2009. Do things stick in your mind at certain moments of big games that is a trigger? Was there anything in 2011 that proved to be a trigger for you?
I think probably there's a... I started on a wing and then moved on ball. And I think there was about a 5 to 10 minute patch where Geelong and Collingwood supporters would probably remember it well. It was right near the interchange bench, and there was repeat stoppage. And you just started to feel around the contest, we're starting to get on top. Like, we're just starting to win those little one-on-one battles. We're, you know, just hitting a bit harder in tackles. We were getting there first. We just seemed to have a bit more run and energy, you know, in that those little tight confines. Like, we were able to power away. Guys were getting their hands free. Matt Stokes kicked a goal after, again, another one of those things, sort of on top of 50 where he skidded it through. It just felt like we were just starting to win those 50-50 battles. Mm. And then Tom Lonergan started, you know, reining Cloak, who kicked two in the first. Like, the individual matchups, it just felt like because there was a bit of movement going around, you know, with different positions, they started to settle and players started to get into their work, if you will. So we come into half time and going, Collingwood absolutely dominate us probably for the first quarter and a little bit. But as we're getting closer and closer to half time, it just felt like this is all coming our way. And the coaching staff were positive. Yes, we've got it. This is what we'll do. For the old first 5 minutes, just pick up where you left off. Just fundamentals, repeat. And it was just, it was super positive in our change rooms because we actually felt like actually we're starting to, you know, the tug of war. Hang on, we've stopped the hole. Now we're starting to pull the rope back our way.
And eventually you pulled it all the way to another premiership. So there's three premierships in 5 seasons.
Yeah. And just on that too, because we lost James Podziadli, who just severely damaged his shoulder. I went to centre forward, if you will, which then completely changed Collingwood's matchups too, because then it meant, you know, someone, I think it was Maxwell, who was up on the wing, then had to come back and play me, which shifted one of their defenders, which all the knock-on effects. So we were getting the advantage, even though we lost a player. Mitch Duncan was the sub. Mitch Duncan, as we know, plenty of run, carry, good ball user. That added something different up around the wing. So out of what seemed adversity with the injuries, it actually sort of played in our favour a little bit.
Was the expectation that it would just keep on going? Because rarely in football does it do that.
Yeah, I think you always expect it. And like I was saying, going back to that conversation in 2007, you just wanted to maximise your time. Like, we're in a great period here. We're all around myself. You go into the change rooms and, you know, you're bending down, putting your football boots on. You look across and you go, these are some of the greatest players ever to walk in this club at one time. How lucky are we? Like, clubs dream of that sort of scenario. That's their eras. It's like, I'm looking across, I've got Corey Enright, like a 5-plus time All-Australian halfback flanker. Matt Scarlett, you know, 5-6 time All-Australian fullback. Like, I've got them everywhere. Okay, if I don't try and capitalise on this, like, it's just a waste. And, you know, you're greedy and things like that. And I'm not taking anything away from the sides that won premierships, but you even look back now going, should we have won 5? Like, you know, obviously 2008, 2013, even my final season when we got jumped at the start, should we have won that one, which the Doggies end up deservedly winning? But you start to do that in your head, you're going, well, we won 3, but did we leave another 2 or 3 on the table?
So when you do come to the end of your career, some of those names you were talking about went a year before you. So there was a changing of the guard, and it was almost inevitable that that would have some sort of consequence there. But it must have been a tough time, I suppose, personally, because you'd gone to war with these guys in a football sense.
Yeah. Yeah, because, and that's the advantage, and that's what you, I probably say to when now you hear young clubs coming through and they always want to make changes. You've got to stick with them because the greatest strength you have in your football football club is continuity. So I think I played close to 200 games alone just with, or 250 games alone just with Corey Enright. I'd start on a wing and he'd be on the same side as a halfback flanker. Do you know how easy it is to play with someone you played 270 games with? Like the ball's coming in, he's clearly going to do that. I can start making a decision.
Yeah.
I think that's probably what was hard for myself and all that senior group is that we're at the absolute elite of elite and they were still playing some really good football that, you know, we're not in a development competition. There's nothing else. So why wouldn't you just keep running with the best players? And if younger players are better, they'll beat them out for the position. So I think that's just because of the environment we're in and the competitive nature of all those players is, well, yeah, you can play, but you've got to beat me out for the position. Now, if they're not better, it's hard to reconcile that when you're a senior player. I think all players were coming to the end of their career going, but I'm still better.
Mm-hmm.
So until you get better than me, I'm not giving up the spot. So that's the difficulty when you're an elite athlete in that environment.
We're just about out of time, Jimmy, but we've still got plenty more to tell. Our final segment coming up on the other side of the break. Jimmy Bartel is my guest on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. We'll be back to wrap things up on the other side of the break.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Almost 200,000 eyeballs here at the ground watching Jimmy Bartel and a kick which has got there!
And the winner of the Norm Smith Medal is Jimmy Bartel.
Our final segment, and we've got so much more to cover, but we've just about run out of time. But Jimmy Bartel has been my guest, and hope you've enjoyed the chat on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. So you come to the end of a great career, 305 games, so much to look back on. We've mentioned it, the Brownlow, the three flags, the Norm Smith Medal, you did it all. But when you look back at your career, you also look back at a man who guided you throughout much of that career, Mark Thompson. Mm. Do you have any contact with him now?
No, contact's dropped off, obviously, because he's had his personal issues. But post-football, yeah, there's a big group. There's so many ex-cats. You can't go to the footy and not run into an ex-cat at some football club. So a lot of us all catch up regularly, just have a beer and just see how each other are going. And Bomber used to come along to those. And look, he's an unbelievable football brain. And some people go, he's different. Yeah, he's different. Tell me what senior coach isn't a little bit crazy.
Yeah, they have to be.
They're mad. Yeah. They're seriously mad. But just such a fortunate time to have him who comes straight in and goes to that young group. Remember I said there was 10 in my draft, 10 above, and a couple either side of that. He said, I will build you to play finals football. Don't worry about winning, you know, games during the season, things like that. I'll give you the brand of football that will win finals football. And you had to believe him. His time at Essendon spoke for that. So straight away you had that. But then you also had Brendan McCartney, goes on to be a senior assistant coach and has an impact wherever he goes. Ken Hinckley, senior coach. Brenton Sanderson, senior coach. Nigel Lappin through that time, one of the greatest players to play in that Brisbane era. Even Blake Carosella towards the end, 2011, won premierships everywhere he went. Lee Tudor has been a senior assistant coach. The coaching staff put around us at that time is one of the best coaching staffs ever, who knew what big time footy was and just taught us brilliantly well.
So many incredible and influential people in your career.
Football coaches and people involved in my local sporting clubs. And I'm forever grateful that I've been lucky to have people like that in my life. Like some incredible people, role models for me, because sport was my great outlet or release from my day-to-day life. And I loved going to training. I was obsessed about training. If you couldn't get me off the training track, they used to try and send me home. But when you look back at it, you know, local footy clubs and cricket clubs, the volunteers, what they give up, like they would have had long days of work, they've got their own family, they've got their own hobbies and interests, but they come, and especially down in Geelong, it's very cold of a winter's night, it's pitch black, it's raining, it's about 8 degrees, and they're standing out on the field for people that they, you know, until they start coaching, they don't know you, they don't have to do this, and they don't have to give their time and care, but the fact that they went out of their way, and, you know, like, a lot of my football coaches still to this day, I still tell them I thank you, and they go, oh, why would you bother doing that? Okay. They don't understand the impact that they've had on my life.
I had the opportunity of doing a similar thing last year with Brian Martin, the great race caller, who took me under his wing when I was a young fella just starting out in broadcasting. And sometimes, whilst you realise the importance of what people are doing along the way, you don't get the opportunity to say thank you as much as you'd like to.
No, spot on. And, you know, like I was saying, they probably don't realise the impact that they're having on me. So I want to tell them, you know, how thankful I am and that I'll never forget it. And I hope at some stage that, you know, I can do that in kind to someone else, you know, the old pay it forward sort of theory there. But, you know, they taught me everything about the game, but just most importantly that, you know, they just cared about you, you know, as a person, and they took time to show interest in you. And when you're a young fellow and you're, you know, life's a bit tough at home and, you know, you show up to a footy club, they just stick their arm around you and just want to know how you're going. It means the world.
It's been great over the last hour to find out more about your football career. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Pete. Really enjoyed it.
Jimmy Bartel joining us on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals. We'll have another guest same time next week, one of the greats of Australian sport. Hope you can join us then.